Republicans and barring blacks from voting. Millions of blacks voted for president for the first time in armed southern black counties that the Klan would not dare to enter, swinging the 1868 presidential election to a Republican war hero, General Ulysses S. Grant. Blacks voted into life what segregationists would begin their struggle to kill, the black politician. "Nigger voting, holding office, and sitting in the jury box are all wrong," blared Mississippi's Columbus Democrat. Nothing is more certain to occur than these outrages upon justice and good government will soon be removed. Numerous Republican congressmen, such as Ohio's James A. Garfield, were privately expressing a strong feeling of repugnance about blacks being made our political equal. But when these racist Republicans calculated the serious advantages the loyal black vote could give them in swing states, they finally gave their support to black suffrage. As with the 13th and 14th Amendments, these powerful congressmen had not been morally persuaded to open the door to black rights. It was about self-interests. On February 27, 1869, the Republican-dominated Congress passed the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It forbade the United States and each state from denying or abridging voting rights on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Congress empowered itself to enforce this article by appropriate legislation, but refused to go any further. Protections for black politicians, uniform voting requirements, and the prohibition of race-veiled measures to exclude blacks, however, were denied. Denied, too, was any serious discussion of enfranchising women. This issue caused dissension between white and black suffragists at the American Equal Rights Association AERA meeting on May 12, 1869, weeks after Congress passed the 15th Amendment. It stung leading suffragist Susan B. Anthony to think the Constitution had recognized black men as the political superiors of all the noble women. They had just emerged from slavery and were not only totally illiterate, but also densely ignorant of every public question. Ironically, sexist men were using similar arguments about women's illiteracy, women's ignorance of public questions, and noble men as the natural political superiors of all women to oppose Anthony's drive for suffrage rights. For instance, George Downing, a black activist and businessman who attended the meeting, spoke of women's obedience being God's will. The AERA meeting went from bad to worse. Feminists challenged him. Downing and other organizers of the Colored National Labor Union, CNLU, came under fire again for this view at their founding meeting later in the year. A black woman from Downing's home state of Rhode Island expressed her disappointment that poor women's interests were not mentioned. In the end, the CNLU admitted its mistakes. It would have been wholly hypocritical for the CNLU to refuse to address gender discrimination, after developing in reaction to the National Labor Union's refusal to address racial discrimination. Then again, hypocrisy had normalized in the American reform movements. Racial, gender, ethnic, and labor activists were angrily challenging the popular bigotry targeting their own groups at the same time they were happily reproducing the popular bigotry targeting other groups. They did not realize that the racist, sexist, ethnocentric, and classist ideas were produced by some of the same powerful minds. The National Labor Union welcomed black delegates to its 1869 convention and proclaimed that it knew neither color nor sex on the question of the rights of labor. Anti-racists and feminists would have preferred for the NLU to accept neither racism nor sexism on the question of the rights of labor, but that was hardly forthcoming. After George Downing's debacle, Frederick Douglass tried to smooth things over by suggesting that AERA members support any measure that extended suffrage to any class heretofore disenfranchised as a cheering part of the triumph of our whole idea. Stanton and Anthony rejected the resolution. Poet Frances Harper, representing the guns of black feminism, chastised white women for only going for sex, letting race occupy a minor position. Sojourner Truth had come to agree with Harper and Douglass. "If you bait the suffrage hook with a woman, you will certainly catch a black man," Truth advised, as only the truth could. The division over the 15th Amendment dissolved the AERA and severed the suffrage movement. The suffrage struggle limped into the 1870s and would not be resolved for women until nearly half a century later. If it had been left up to the first generation of black male politicians, women may have received voting rights in the 1870s. All 6 black Massachusetts legislators and 6 of 7 black U.S. representatives from South Carolina, for example, supported women's suffrage. Susan B. Anthony may have privately realized that black men were not densely ignorant of every public question, including her right to vote. Democrats tried to block the ratification of the 15th Amendment, demeaning it as a nigger superiority bill meant to establish horrific and barbaric black supremacy. They had no luck. The amendment was ratified on February 3, 1870. Black people from Boston to Richmond to Vicksburg, Mississippi, planned grand celebrations after the ratification. For their keynote speaker, several communities invited a living legend. Chapter 20. Reconstructing Blame. William Lloyd Garrison decided to stay home and witness the magnificent 2-hour procession of dignitaries, especially the veterans of the 54th and 55th Massachusetts Regiments. When Garrison stepped to the podium of Faneuil Hall at the close of the celebration of the passage of the 15th Amendment, he looked older than his 64 years, tired and ready to step fully out of public life. He regarded the 15th Amendment as a miracle. The members of the American Anti-Slavery Society, meanwhile, felt their work was finished. They officially disbanded on April 9, 1870. The 15th Amendment confers upon the African race the care of its own destiny. It places their fortunes in their own hands, imagined Ohio Congressman James A. Garfield. An Illinois newspaper proclaimed, "The Negro is now a voter and a citizen. Let him hereafter take his chances in the battle of life." The passage of the 15th Amendment caused Republicans to turn their backs on the struggle against racial discrimination. After refusing to redistribute land and giving landless blacks the ability to choose their own masters and calling that freedom, after handing poor blacks an equal rights statement they could use in the expensive courts and calling that equality, they put the ballot in the black man's hand and call that security. The ballot is the citadel of the colored man's safety, parodied one black Southerner, the guarantor of his liberty, the protector of his rights, the defender of his immunities and privileges, the savior of the fruits of his toil, his weapon of offense and defense, his peacemaker, his nemesis that watches and guards over him with sleepless eye by day and by night. As this black Southerner knew so well, the ballot never did stop all those hooded night riders. Klan violence was needed to keep the niggers in their place, explained Confederate General Nathan Bedford Forrest, the Klan's first honorary Grand Wizard. To the Klan, the only thing worse than a Negro was a white radical. But the worst offender was a suspected black rapist of a white woman. Klansmen glorified white womanhood as the epitome of honor and purity and asexuality, and demeaned black womanhood as the epitome of immorality and filth and sex. Some black men demeaned black women, too. "Lord, sir," said a prosperous black Kansan, "you not think I marry a black nigger wench?" Klansmen religiously believed that blacks possessed supernatural sexual powers, and this belief fueled their sexual attraction to black women and their fear of white women being attracted to black men. It became almost standard operating procedure to justify Klan terrorism by maintaining that Southern white supremacy was necessary to defend the purity of white women. Black women's bodies, in contrast, were regarded as a training ground for white men, or a stabilizing safety valve for white men's sexual energies that allowed the veneration of the asexual pureness of white womanhood to continue. The other threat to white male dominance were upwardly mobile black people. Klan terrorism showed the charade that was always the strategy of uplift suasion. "The Klan did not like to see the Negro go ahead," reported a white Mississippian. Landless blacks were terrorized by landowners. Landowning blacks were terrorized by the Klan. In March 1870, President Grant sent to Congress documentary evidence of more than 5,000 cases of white terrorism. Between May 1870 and April 1871, Congress passed three poorly funded enforcement acts that dispatched election supervisors to the South, criminalized interference with black voting, and turned a wide range of Klan-type terrorist acts into federal offenses. As a result, the Klan had nominally dissolved by 1871, but the train of terror still rushed down the tracks under new names. It became clear to all, as a northern transplant explained, that only steady, unswerving power from without could guarantee peace and the survival of Southern republicanism. A steady, unswerving black power from within could have done so too, but Republicans remained unwilling to fortify blacks with Buffalo soldiers and land. The vote was supposed to make miracles, and in some ways it did. Southern constitutional conventions from 1867 to 1869 were a revolutionary sight to behold. They included Northern transplants, Southern Republicans, and Southern black delegates, about half of whom had been born in slavery. For all their lack of political experience, wealth, and schooling, or rather because of it, these delegates produced alluringly democratic constitutions. They instituted the South's first publicly funded educational systems, penitentiaries, orphanages, and insane asylums, expanded women's rights and guaranteed black rights, reduced the number of crimes, and reorganized local governments to eliminate dictatorships. Initially, however, black politicians stepped aside when the positions of power were divided up because they did not want to lend credibility to persistent democratic charges of black supremacy, as if the charge had some logic to it. While blacks rarely benefited from Reconstruction's economic policies, growing corporations did. Facing war-torn communities and treasuries, the same Reconstruction politicians who refused to hand out land and aid to landless blacks on the pretext that it would ruin them handed millions out to railroad companies on the pretext that railroads would develop the South by bringing new jobs, factories, and towns, allow for transport of untapped minerals, and extend agriculture. By 1872, most of the South only had debt and poverty to show for the incredible amounts of welfare handed out to railroad corporations. Bribed politicians happily gave away these funds. Only a small number of black politicians sat in senior positions of power, and thus their share of the corruption paled in comparison to that of white politicians. Every dollar taken from Southern treasuries heightened Southern reliance on cheap labor. President Grant figured that maybe if blacks had somewhere else to go, planters would value black labor more. Actually, planters did value cheap labor, and they used their guns and racist ideas to keep black labor as cheap as possible. In early 1870, Grant began a presidential push for the annexation of the Dominican Republic to provide a haven for the entire colored population of the United States, should it choose to immigrate. He sent Frederick Douglass on a fact-finding mission in 1871. The DR can not only become a black haven, the impressed Douglass reported, but by transplanting within her tropical borders the glorious institutions of the United States, the blacks who moved there could uplift the impoverished and backward Dominican people. Douglass seemed unaware that he was recycling against Dominicans the very same racist ideas that had been used against African Americans. And if the U.S. institutions were so glorious, then why did African Americans need a foreign haven? Assimilationists like Douglass encouraged American expansion, while segregationists and anti-racists discouraged it, bringing the ongoing racial dispute into foreign policy. The U.S. Senate voted down the annexation treaty in June 1871. Tired of Grant's preoccupation with annexation and his openness to using federal power to protect Southern black lives, Republican dissidents broke away. In May 1872, New York Tribune editor Horace Greeley and Illinois Senator Lyman Trumbull, central forces in the passage of the Reconstruction Amendments, headlined an assembly of liberal Republicans in Cincinnati. "Reconstruction and slavery we have done with," declared E.L. Godkin, the editor of The Nation, speaking for the liberal Republicans. They pledged amnesty and voting rights for ex-Confederates, the end of federal Southern intervention, welfare for the rich in the form of tax breaks, and nothing for the poor. Greeley emerged as their presidential candidate. The arch enemy of the Confederacy became the arch friend of the Confederacy, similar to the nation's most famous preacher, whom Frederick Douglass sarcastically called the Apostle of Forgiveness. Seeking to reunite white Northerners and Southerners through Christian whiteness, Henry Ward Beecher published the first American biography of Jesus, The Life of Jesus the Christ, in 1871. "There is absolutely nothing to determine the personal appearance of Jesus," wrote Harriet Beecher Stowe's brother. And yet, Beecher included in the book five depictions of the perfect God-man named Jesus, and they all depicted a white man. Henry Ward Beecher gave white Americans a model for embedding whiteness into their religious worldviews of Jesus Christ without ever saying so out loud, just as Southern and Northern whites were doing with their political worldviews. It went without saying for racists that white people were the best equipped to rule the United States under the heavenly guidance of the white Father and Son. Horace Greeley had long been associated with emancipation and equality, but he made himself over in order to campaign as the Democratic candidate for president in 1872. "Political equality is far off," he lectured blacks. "Social equality will remain forever out of reach. Don't expect free gifts of land. Segregate yourself. Employ each other. Who are your best friends? Sound, conservative, knowing white Southerners." These knowing white Southerners made it known to black people, as one South Carolinian observed, that to vote against the wishes of their white employers and neighbors was to risk death. Congress issued a report in the spring of 1872 condemning Southern violence, but it only went so far. The report even adopted the segregationist position, arguing that blacks were the cause. The violence, the report explained, was a response to the bad legislation, official incompetency, and corruption of black politicians. It hardly mattered that Southern white politicians sat in the overwhelming majority of the powerful and corruptible positions. The truth hardly mattered to the producers of these racist ideas, who were seeking to defend the racist policies of buckling black political power. Grant's former Secretary of the Interior, Jacob Cox, said Southerners could only be governed through the part of the community that embodies the intelligence and the capital. The nation, put it more bluntly, Reconstruction had totally failed. Enough blacks and Republican whites risked death to win most of the South and President Grant's re-election in 1872. On Southern streets, armed Republicans had to defend their re-elected politicians. In Colfax, Louisiana, 61 armed blacks barricaded themselves inside a courthouse on Easter Sunday, 1873. Democrats shelled the courthouse with artillery, snatched out the 37 survivors, and executed them in the town square. The day after the Colfax massacre, the U.S. Supreme Court, including Grant's four corporate lawyer appointees, massacred the civil rights protections of the 14th Amendment in the slaughterhouse cases. White New Orleans butchers felt their economic privileges and immunities were being denied by the bribe-instigated 1869 Louisiana statute requiring them to do business at the slaughterhouse company. Writing for the majority, Justice Samuel Miller upheld the monopoly on April 14, 1873, distinguishing between national and state citizenship and citing Roger B. Taney's Dred Scott opinion. The 14th Amendment only protected the relatively few rights of national citizens, Miller stated. 3 years later, this doctrinaire, split between national and state citizenship, allowed a unanimous Supreme Court to reverse the convictions of the perpetrators of the Colfax massacre. Murder prosecutions rests alone with the states, thus giving Louisiana the freedom to exonerate them. The court also voided the enforcement acts and encouraged white terrorist organizations just in time for the election of 1876. None of the four slaughterhouse dissenters objected to the most far-reaching part of Justice Miller's majority opinion. "We doubt very much whether any action of a state not directed by way of discrimination against the Negroes as a class, or on account of their race, will ever come within the purview of this provision." To this day, the Supreme Court still uses Miller's doctrine to shield private and race-veiled discriminators, those who veil policies intended to discriminate against black people by not using racial language. Neither ex-Confederates voting again nor the slaughterhouse ruling could compare to the destructive force of the Panic of 1873. It was the first major economic depression of American industrial capitalism and lasted the rest of the decade. Southern Democrats declared their ability to restore order. Just as the oil man John D. Rockefeller and the steel man Andrew Carnegie declared their ability to monitor their industries. By the end of the century, the Rockefeller and Carnegie monopolies reflected the white political monopolies steering the South. As the poorest of the poor, Southern blacks were the most devastated of the devastated by the Panic of 1873. The panic halted the modest post-war ascent of black landowners, snatching their land and their freedom. When legions of small white landowners lost their land too, they felt as if they were losing their whiteness and freedom. "Whites must have small plots of land," one planter complained, "and prefer tending them, poor as may be the return, to lowering themselves as they think it by hiring to another." Holding out hope for redistributed land as long as they could, rural Southern blacks walked backward into sharecropping, meaning they handed the landowner a share of the crop as payment for the ability to farm there. Crooked landowners maneuvered sharecroppers into debt, and laws prevented sharecroppers from leaving landowners to whom they owed money. Blacks who were able to leave a bad situation took to the road, looking endlessly for ethical landowners. Landowners called this annual movement a sign of black shiftlessness. Stuck between racist policies and ideas, sharecroppers could not win. Staying often meant servitude, but leaving meant shiftlessness. Nothing seemed to dent racist ideas, not even upwardly mobile urban blacks. In 1874, Nashville's white-owned Republican Banner praised the thrifty and cleanly blacks. But they could not be taken as the representative of the indolent and shiftless hundreds of thousands, the Banner opined. They were extraordinary. By the early 1870s, given the snatching away from blacks' civil rights, William Lloyd Garrison had no choice but to make his voice heard once again. He ridiculed the abandonment of Reconstruction in essay after essay in The Independent, and in open letter in the Boston Journal. Vice President Henry Wilson complained to Garrison of a counter-revolution overtaking Reconstruction. "Our anti-slavery veterans must again speak out," Wilson urged. Some failed to speak out because they were too busy blaming black people for the failures of Reconstruction, and how could they not? Northern press reports regularly depicted black voters and politicians as self-destructively stupid and corrupt. The Associated Press relied on anti-black, anti-Reconstruction Southern papers for daily dispatches. New York Tribune reporter James S. Pike blanketed Northerners with racist fairy tales of corrupt, incompetent, lazy black politicians who conquered and deprived white South Carolinians during the tragedy of Reconstruction. These claims were published in his widely circulated newspaper articles in 1873, republished as "The Prostrate State, South Carolina Under Negro Government in 1874. Pike's Democratic sources were happy to blame the Southern corruption on black people, as it diverted attention from their principal role in the corruption. Pike's well-written novel passed as eyewitness journalism. In the place of this old aristocratic society stands the rude form of the most ignorant democracy that mankind ever saw, Pike wrote. It is barbarism overwhelming civilization, and the slave rioting in the halls of his master, and putting that master under his feet. The Prostrate State caused pro-Reconstruction periodicals, Scribner's, Harper's, The Nation, and The Atlantic Monthly, to pummel black legislators even more, and demand a national reunion of white rule. A New York Democrat read from The Prostrate State on the House floor. "Where's your book on New York corruption?" asked black South Carolina Congressman Robert Small. Though the bribers and the bribed knew corruption was a national affair, primarily among white politicians, racist ideas never did quite subscribe to the magazine of reality. Black corruption was a ready-made excuse to abandon the increasingly difficult, expensive, disordering, and divisive Reconstruction policies. Every time Grant's administration intervened to protect black lives, he alienated Northern and Southern whites from the Republican Party. During the 1874 midterm elections, Democrats knocked Republicans out of control of the House of Representatives and out of power in every southern state except Mississippi, Louisiana, South Carolina, and Florida. White terrorist organizations warred with armed and unarmed black voters across the South. President Grant had to send troops to prevent an army of 3,500 Democrats from forcing out elected Republicans in New Orleans in September 1874. Wendell Phillips was jeered off a Boston stage for trying to defend Grant. The New York Times reported that Wendell Phillips and William Lloyd Garrison are not exactly extinct from American politics, but they represent ideas in regard to the South, which the majority of the Republican Party have outgrown. The final bill of Radical Reconstruction was pushed through Congress in early 1875, before the new Democrats took office. The Civil Rights Act of 1875 was a legislative memorial to Senator Charles Sumner, who died in 1874 after decades in the anti-slavery and civil rights trenches. The bill outlawed racial discrimination in jury selection, public transportation, and public accommodations, but it required blacks to seek redress in the expensive and hostile courts. The bill hardly stopped the terror campaign against Mississippi's black voters that allowed Democrats to gain state control in the fall 1875 election. Mississippi's embattled Republican governor, Adelbert Ames, declared that a revolution is taking place by force of arms and a race are disenfranchised. They are to be returned to a condition of serfdom, an era of second slavery. A southern newspaper declared that the 14th and 15th Amendments may stand forever, but we intend to make them dead letters. With Reconstruction of Southern Democracy on life support, the United States celebrated the 100th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. From May to November 1876, roughly one-fifth of the U.S. population attended the first of the official World Fairs, Philadelphia's Centennial Exposition. A band of old-time plantation darkies singing songs at the Southern Restaurant was the only display depicting black people. In Boston, William Lloyd Garrison gave an Independence Day address for the ages. The shift in public opinion away from Reconstruction was the consequence of emancipating black people as a military necessity rather than as an act of general repentance, he said. In his last major public speech, Garrison recognized racist ideas as the core of the problem. "We must give up the spirit of complexional caste," Garrison declared, "or give up Christianity." In Hamburg, South Carolina, the local black militia celebrated the July 4th centennial with a parade. Area racists hated the militia for maintaining blacks' ability to control the majority black town. During the parade, harsh words were exchanged when a local white farmer ordered militia members to move aside for his carriage. The farmer appealed to former Confederate General Matthew C. Butler, the area's most powerful Democrat. On July 8th, Butler and a small posse ordered the militia head, the Union Army veteran Doc Adams, to disarm the Hamburg militia. Adams refused, and fighting broke out. The militiamen retreated to their armory. Butler dashed off for nearby Augusta, but returned with hundreds of reinforcements and cannon. Butler's contingent executed five militiamen and looted and destroyed the undefended homes and shops of Hamburg. When Southerners complained of their lost cause, an appalled President Grant realized they were complaining of their lost freedom to kill Negroes and Republicans without fear of punishment and without loss of caste or reputations. General Butler made a mockery of the congressional investigation, capitalizing on the attention by being elected to the U.S. Senate in 1877. He blamed the massacre on innate black criminality. Blacks, he said, possessed little regard for human life. General Butler was invoking blacks' natural proclivity for violence and criminality to avoid punishment for the massacre he had carried out. But hardly any congressional investigators questioned his motive for expressing these racist ideas, which at the time were being codified by a prison doctor in Italy. Cesare Lombroso proved in 1876 that non-white men love to kill, mutilate the corpse, tear its flesh, and drink its blood. His Criminal Man gave birth to the discipline of criminology in 1876. Criminals were born, not bred, Lombroso said. He believed that born criminals emitted physical signs that could be studied, measured, and quantified, and that the inability to blush, and therefore dark skin, had always been considered the accompaniment of crime. black women in their close degree of differentiation from the male, he claimed in The Female Offender in 1895, were the prototypical female criminals. As white terrorists brutalized, raped, and killed people in communities around the black world, the first crop of Western criminologists were intent on giving criminals a black face and the well-behaved citizen a white face. Lombroso's student, Italian law professor Raffaele Garofalo, invented the term criminology, criminologia, in 1885. British physician Havelock Ellis popularized Lombroso in the English-speaking world, publishing a compendium of his writings in 1890. The Hamburg perpetrators kept shouting, "This is the beginning of the redemption of the South." Indeed, it was. When the election of 1876 came in November, it was war at the polls, and Democrats stuffed ballot boxes across the South. By the morning of November 8, 1876, Democratic New York Governor Samuel J. Tilden and Republican Ohio Governor Rutherford B. Hayes were virtually tied in the Electoral College. The presidential election's outcome rested in the contested election returns of Louisiana and South Carolina. When a 15-member Electoral Commission handed Republicans the presidency, Democrats were outraged. In early 1877, both parties and both regions began planning for another civil war. The parties and regions remained united on one issue. Blacks must quell their new-kindled ambition and recognize their lack of whites' hereditary faculty of self-government, said former Ohio Governor Jacob D. Cox. Outgoing President Grant privately told his cabinet that giving black men the ballot had been a mistake, and so did Republican presidential hopeful Rutherford B. Hayes. While a consensus formed on who should govern the South, division intensified over who should govern in Washington, D.C. The nation on the brink, Hayes's representatives met with Democrats at the Wormley House, a hotel owned by the Capitol's richest African American. No one ever revealed the exact terms of the bargain of 1877, but Democrats handed Republican Rutherford B. Hayes the presidency, while Hayes ended Reconstruction for the Democrats. Hayes recognized the stolen Democratic governments in Louisiana and South Carolina. He withdrew federal troops from the South and used those troops to crush the Great Strike of 1877. As capital regained control of labor, the Knights of Labor materialized as the principal national labor organization. Knights head Terence V. Powderly demanded unions' desegregation to control the competition. He considered blacks a lazy reservoir of cheap labor that could easily be used against white labor. The nation made the bargain of 1877 plain. The time had come for the Negro to disappear from the field of national politics, said the news magazine. Henceforth, the nation, as a nation, will have nothing more to do with him. Meanwhile, William Lloyd Garrison labeled the bargain an abomination amounting to the old covenant with death. When troops departed Shreveport, Louisiana, a black man grieved about his people being back in the hands of the very men that held them as slaves, so that there was no way on earth they could better their condition. "Not one single right enjoyed by the colored people shall be taken from them," pledged the new Democratic South Carolina governor, Wade Hampton. As the Negro becomes more intelligent, Hampton added, he naturally allies himself with the more conservative whites. For his observation and experience both show him that his interests are identified with those of the white race here. Hampton opened two doors for blacks in post-Reconstruction South Carolina: naturally submissive intelligence, or naturally rebellious stupidity. The Reconstruction era, the dozen or so years following the end of the Civil War in 1865, had been a horrific time for Southern white men, like Wade Hampton, who were used to ruling their black people and their women. They faced and beat back with violence and violent ideas a withering civil rights and black empowerment movement, as well as a powerful women's movement that failed to grab as many headlines. But their supposed underlings did not stop rebelling after the fall of Reconstruction. To intimidate and reassert their control over rebellious blacks and white women, white male redeemers took up lynching in the 1880s. Someone was lynched on average every 4 days from 1889 to 1929. Often justifying the ritualistic slaughters on a false rumor that the victim had raped a white woman, white men, women, and children gathered to watch the torture, killing, and dismemberment of human beings, all the while calling the victims savages. Hate fueled the lynching era, but behind this hatred lay racist ideas that had evolved to question black freedoms at every stage. And behind these racist ideas were powerful white men striving by word and deed to regain absolute political, economic, and cultural control of the South. Southern black people felt a range of emotions as they trekked from slavery to war to emancipation to radical reconstruction to black redemption to white redemption. Their feelings seemed to have resembled the range of emotions a parent might feel living through the exciting birth, hopeful growth, and tragic death of a beloved child. Some blacks, angry over Reconstruction's demise, felt the need to run away from their second slavery. "It is impossible for us to live with these slaveholders of the South," said one Louisiana organizer, representing more than 60,000 hard-laboring people eager to flee the South. Resettlement to Africa, or the North, or far west, was not nearly as popular in the late 1870s as the exodus to Kansas. The Exodusters ignored the opposition of Frederick Douglass and increased Kansas's black population by 150%. Northern allies did all they could to fundraise for Exodusters. William Lloyd Garrison, at 74 years old, exhausted himself raising money for hundreds of black Exodusters fleeing Mississippi and Louisiana. On April 24, 1879, Garrison had hoped to address a rally for the Exodusters at Boston's Faneuil Hall, but he was too weak to attend. Still, he made sure his voice was heard, sending a reverberating statement. "Let the edict go forth, trumpet-tongued, that there shall be a speedy end put to all this bloody misrule, that the millions of loyal colored citizens at the South, now under ban and virtually disenfranchised, shall be put in the safe enjoyment of their rights, shall freely vote and be fairly represented, just where they are located. And let the rallying cry be heard from the Atlantic to the Pacific coast, liberty and equal rights for each, for all, and forever, wherever the lot of man is cast without our broad domains." He had hoped for immediate emancipation when all hope had been lost. He now hoped for immediate equality when all hope had been lost. The thrilling statement of hope on April 24, 1879, proved to be the last will and testament of William Lloyd Garrison. 4 weeks later, he was dead. Part 4. W.E.B. Du Bois. Chapter 21. Renewing the South. The slave went free, stood a brief moment in the sun, then moved back again towards slavery. W.E.B. Du Bois had lived almost 7 decades before he gave this classic summation of the Reconstruction era. He was born under the sun on February 23, 1868, the day before the impeachment of President Andrew Johnson. While Garrison applauded Johnson's impeachment from the eastern end of Massachusetts, Willie Du Bois came into being on the western end of Massachusetts, in the small town of Great Barrington. He grew up between 2 encircling mountain ranges, the Berkshires to the east and the Taconic Chain to the west, assimilationist ideas to the north and segregationist ideas to the south. Mary Sylvina Burgard raised Willie. Alfred Du Bois, Willie's Franco-Haitian father, had left his wife and child for Connecticut by 1870. Burgard became the single mother of 2 boys. She had already birthed the only out-of-wedlock child in recent family memory, Willie's older half-brother, Adelbert. In a way, Burgard resembled Garrison's mother, Frances Maria Lloyd, who had defied her family, lived on the social edge, married a rover, and, after being deserted and devastated, poured what was left of herself into her children. And their prized youngest sons wanted nothing more than to make their distressed mothers happy. Willie gleaned his first sense of racial difference on an interracial playground at 10 years old in 1878. The exchange of gorgeous visiting cards was merry, till one girl, a tall newcomer, refused my card, refused it peremptorily with a glance. Then it dawned upon me with a certain suddenness that I was different from the others, he later wrote. From then on, Willie Du Bois fiercely competed with his white peers in the game of uplift suasion, in an attempt to prove to the world that Negroes were just like other people. He would go on to hike and reach the summit of the European intellectual world. However, he did not like what he saw when he reached the top. In the 1870s and 1880s, No matter what Willie and other young blacks like him achieved in school and in life, they were not changing the minds of the discriminators. The discriminators were subscribing to social Darwinism and to the idea that blacks were losing the racial struggle for existence. For ages, enslavers had pictured black people as physically hardy, hardy enough to survive the heat of southern enslavement. With emancipation, racist ideas progressed to suit this new world. Discriminators started picturing blacks as weak, too weak to survive in freedom, beings that desperately needed to learn to be strong without their masters and government assistance. In 1883, the U.S. Supreme Court declared the Civil Rights Act of 1875 unconstitutional. Civil rights activists loudly protested the funeral of the Reconstruction era, but not loud enough for a 15-year-old lad in Great Barrington. Willie Du Bois launched his publishing career, complaining about local indifference to the court ruling in T. Thomas Fortune's immensely popular black newspaper, The New York Globe. Drowning out the young Willies and the older Fortunes in 1883, the United North and South held the decision to trash the 1875 Civil Rights Act. The New York Times applauded the Supreme Court's useful purpose in undoing the work of Congress. In the majority opinion, Justice Joseph Bradley wrote that the 13th and 14th Amendments did not bestow on Congress any power to prohibit discrimination in privately run public accommodations, but only state action that denied equal protection of the laws. When a man has emerged from slavery, and with the aid of beneficent legislation has shaken off the inseparable concomitants of that state, Bradley concluded, there must be some stage in the progress of his elevation when he takes the rank of a mere citizen, and ceases to be a special favorite of the laws, and when his rights are to be protected in the ordinary modes by which other men's rights are protected. A mere citizen without special favors protected in the ordinary modes? Did Justice Bradley not understand that black people only wanted to be mere citizens? Did Justice Bradley not understand that their rights were not being protected from planters and Klansmen? Maybe the New York-born Bradley was indeed in the dark, especially if he believed the optimistic propaganda of what was being billed as the New South. Atlanta Constitution editor Henry W. Grady was the chief propagandist of the New South in the 1880s. The friendliness that existed between the master and slave has survived war and strife and political campaigns, Grady imagined. Methodist bishop and Emory College president Atticus Haygood also marketed the New South in speeches across the country, and in his popular 1881 book, Our Brother in Black. The great majority of the slaves did truly love the white people, Haygood presumed. White enslavers taught them labor, habits, English, the principles of free institutions, and Christianity. Whites must continue the elevating legacy of slavery in a nicely segregated free labor society, Haygood instructed. How could wise whites teach unwise blacks if the races were separated? Haygood disregarded the contradiction. But an Episcopal bishop, Thomas U. Dudley, could not. He opposed racial separation because it would mean continued and increasing degradation and decay for blacks. Their hope for salvation must come from association with white people, Dudley stressed. A famous New Orleans novelist of pre-war Creole life, George Washington Cable, also challenged these New South segregationists, inviting their wrath. In April 1885, Grady issued his official reply in Century Magazine to Cable and other assimilationist and anti-racist critics. The assortment of races is wise and proper, and stands on the platform of equal accommodations for each race, but separate. With that statement, Grady birthed the New South's defense of racial segregation. The system of separation had been created to ensure racial inequality. Yet Grady propagated the notion that it was intended to ensure racial equality and bring racial progress. Truth never did stop the concoctors of racist ideas. Grady had a separate but equal brand to invent, to defend, and to sell to the American mind, and millions of Americans bought it in the 1880s. In buying this new South, Americans had adopted a new tool for blaming racial disparities on black people. Faith in racial progress and ignoring the simultaneous progression of racism. It was being taught that American slavery had developed those backward people who had been brought over from the grips of Africa. Northern missionaries and New South stalwarts, it was said, were developing those backward people who were now freed from the grips of slavery. And the Reconstruction Amendments claimed the proponents of the New South had indeed lessened racial discrimination and brought an equal opportunity. All this racist propaganda coalesced into an indelible post-war faith in racial progress, specifically that prejudice against color is slowly but surely dying out, as a Philadelphia newspaper reported in 1888. An aversion to industry and frugality, not discrimination, caused the socioeconomic disparities between the races, the newspaper stated. Racial progress became the most powerful racist rejoinder to anti-racists who were still pointing out discrimination and disparities. The New South really became the new America of racial progress. Social Darwinists, conjuring black regression since slavery, and Confederate holdovers of the Old South rejected the New South's racial progress brand and the separate but equal formulation. The Reverend Robert L. Dabney, one of Southern Presbyterianism's most influential intellectuals and an old Confederate Army chaplain, argued that only enslavement could provide black people with a civilizing education. Lawyer-turned-writer Thomas Nelson Page spent his writing career sharply contrasting what he considered the hard, industrializing capitalism and the disobedient African of the New South with the soft, agricultural capitalism and the obedient African of the Old South. Through his short story collection In Old Virginia, or Marsh Chan and Others, 1887, Page pioneered the post-war plantation school of fiction, a carbon copy of the pre-war idyllic plantation fiction, reimagining his lovely childhood days surrounded by happy captives on his Virginia plantation. And then, in 1889, the most popular anti-New South book appeared, The Plantation Negro as a Free Man. Harvard alumnus Philip Alexander Bruce, Page's brother-in-law, claimed that black people, cut off from their civilizing white masters, had degenerated back into the African type, leading to bold and forward black women advancing on white men, black male criminals raping white women, compelling white men to lynch them, and black parents producing problem children who were less inclined to work. As a teenager, Willie Du Bois had dreamed of going to Harvard. Charitable local whites, unwilling to send their town's extraordinary Negro to the nation's best historically white college, raised funds in 1885 to send him to the nation's best historically black college, Fisk University of Nashville. Controlled by white philanthropists and instructors, Fisk was one of the nation's preeminent factories of uplift suasion and assimilationist ideas. Du Bois consumed these ideas like his peers and started reproducing them when he became the editor of Fisk's student newspaper, The Herald. In one of his published pieces, he eagerly reviewed the first full-length history of African Americans, George Washington Williams' History of the Negro Race in America from 1619 to 1880. At last, Du Bois rejoiced, black people have a historian. Other reviews of the book, which was first released in 1883, were also favorable, but one critique from the Magazine of American History, saying that Williams was not sufficiently restrained, signified the conundrum that many black revisionist scholars would face in future decades. When black revisionists chose not to revise, then they seemingly allowed racist studies excluding or denigrating blacks to stand for truth. When they did revise racist scholarship, they apparently lacked objectivity. Only white scholars apparently could be sufficiently restrained to write on race. Only racist studies reflected scholarly truth. Williams' major anti-racist and sexist historical revision had been to show that black male Americans had played an integral part of U.S. history. He challenged the racist ideas of scholars arguing that black people had regressed since slavery with his own racist ideas of the weak black man and the strong black woman. Williams liberally cited from the 1864 tract, Savage Africa. If the women of Africa are brutal, he wrote, the men of Africa are feminine. According to Williams' assimilationist reading of history, freedom had facilitated black adoption of civilized values and norms, of better and purer traits of character. Black women have risen to take their places in society. Black men were again becoming enduring in affection and benevolent to a fault. Du Bois embraced Williams' history and seemed to have been influenced by the book's assimilationist ideas and gender racism. In his Fisk graduation speech in June 1888, Du Bois offered the founder and first chancellor of Germany, Otto von Bismarck, as a model for black leadership. Bismarck was well known for bringing together dozens of communities to form the mighty Germany in 1871. Du Bois said that Bismarck's Second Reich should serve as a model for African Americans marching forth with strength and determination under trained leadership. He did not mind that Bismarck had hosted the Berlin Conference in 1885, where European colonizers had partitioned Africa on the dishonest pretext that they were bringing civilization to the continent. "I did not understand at all, nor had my history courses led me to understand," he later admitted, "that colonialism had so viciously exploited African raw materials and labor. I was blithely European and imperialistic in outlook." After Fisk, Du Bois was able to pursue his dream to attend Harvard. He left for the North in 1888 at a time when racist Southerners were calmly debating two paths for the Negro. Should they be carefully civilized or rigidly segregated from whites? As the New South Democrats tried to hold off Jim Crow Democrats, Republicans regained the President's House and Congress in the 1888 elections. In his first message to Congress in 1889, President Benjamin Harrison asked, "When is the Negro, in fact, to have those full civil rights which have so long been his in law?" Never, as far as Jim Crow segregationists were concerned. Chapter 22, Southern Horrors. South Carolina Senator Matthew Butler and Alabama Senator and former Ku Klux Klan Grand Dragon John Tyler Morgan introduced a congressional bill on January 7, 1890, to fund black immigration to Africa. It was an ingenious solution to the class and racial problems of big Southern landowners. Withering under a Southern agricultural depression, many white dirt farmers were raging against the black farmers. Others were joining with blacks to rage against white landowners in the rising interracial, anti-racist populist movement. The immigration bill was a deflective measure. It pointed white farmers to Southern blacks and not rich white landowners as the chief cause of the Southern agrarian depression. White farmers could easily see how the mass ejection of Southern blacks would increase their labor value. Americans were probably more open to immigration in 1890 than at any time since Abraham Lincoln's urgings during the Civil War. Caribbean-born Liberian diplomat Edward Wilmot Blyden was touring the United States proclaiming that African Americans had been schooled and preserved by slavery for their divine mission to redeem Africa. "God has a way of salting as well as purifying by fire," Blyden wrote in the American Colonization Society's journal in 1890. The writings of Henry Morton Stanley, the 19th century's most famous English-speaking explorer of Africa, were in mass circulation. Nearly every English speaker interested in Africa read Stanley's Through the Dark Continent, 1878, and nearly everyone who read Stanley came away viewing African people as savages, including novelist Joseph Conrad, who authored the classic Heart of Darkness in 1899. The white character's journey up the Congo River was like traveling back to the earliest beginning of the world, not back in chronological time, but back in evolutionary time. In his January 1890 speech before the Senate to push the immigration bill, John Tyler Morgan read from Henry Morgan Stanley. Under white tutelage, African Americans had been civilized to a level from which they could now pull Africa out of the depths of barbarism, Morgan said. He hoped that potential black immigrants would be as kind and patient and generous towards their own kindred as we white Southerners have been to them. Although millions of American citizens supported the bill, the austere opposition held the day, and it never became law. Watching this immigration debate unfold only emboldened a zealous Democrat in Omaha, Nebraska. Walter Vaughn, the son of Alabama slaveholders, believed that his scheme would benefit the tattered condition of the emancipated people who, in his mind, had been well cared for during slavery. The business owner proposed that the federal government provide pensions for ex-slaves, who would then spend their money buying things from struggling white Southern businesses. Vaughn convinced his congressman, Republican William J. Connell, to introduce the Ex-Slave Pension Bill in 1890. With Frederick Douglass as one of the few supportive black elites, the reparations bill died a quiet death. And yet, Vaughn continued to press for ex-slave pensions. He published the pamphlet Freedmen's Pension Bill, a plea for American freedmen, and soon, 10,000 worn copies of it were being passed from hand to hand in poor black communities in the South and Midwest. Callie House, an ex-slave and washerwoman in Tennessee, came across the pamphlet in 1891, and then she helped formulate the National Ex-Slave Mutual Relief Bounty and Pension Association, based in Nashville, Tennessee. Claiming hundreds of thousands of members, this organization gave birth to the reparations movement of the 1890s, a movement demanding restitution for the unpaid labors of American slavery. The movement was furiously supported by anti-racist poor blacks and furiously opposed by the same class racism that had prevented Congress from giving blacks their 40 acres and a mule after the Civil War. Black elites joining their white peers typically ignored or castigated reparations bills. Economic injustices affecting low-income blacks took a backseat to education and voting injustices among black elites. The most learned Negroes, Callie House scolded, have less interest in their race than any other Negro, as many of them are fighting against the welfare of their race. On June 25, 1890, W.E.B. Du Bois spoke at his Harvard graduation ceremony. He had now excelled and had graduated from the most prestigious historically black college and the most prestigious historically white college in the United States. He felt he was showing off the capability of his race. Du Bois's brilliant and eloquent address, as judged by the reporters, was on Jefferson Davis as representative of civilization. In Du Bois's rendering, Jefferson Davis, who had died the year before, represented the rugged individualism and domineering European civilization, in contrast to the rugged submission and selflessness of African civilization. The European met civilization and crushed it, Du Bois concluded. The Negro met civilization and was crushed by it. According to Du Bois's biographer, the Harvard graduate contrasted the civilized European strong man to the civilized African submissive man. Du Bois had clearly been influenced by Harriet Beecher Stowe's post-war New England, where ideas on race seemed to start and end in Uncle Tom's cabin. At Harvard, he had also been influenced by one of the professors, the historian Albert Hart, a hard-line moralist who deemed character the inner man, not the outer, as the key to social change. Du Bois consumed from Hart and other assimilationists the racist idea that African Americans had been socially and morally crippled by slavery and Africa. Du Bois had more faith in future development than his professor did. In his 1910 travel book, The Southern South, Hart claimed that the Negro is inferior, and his past history in Africa and in America leads to the belief that he will remain inferior. Thinking about Du Bois specifically, Hart reduced his talents to his European ancestry. Du Bois was living proof, Hart wrote confidentially, that a mulatto may have as much power and passion as any white man. In the fall of 1890, Du Bois entered Harvard's history doctoral program to study under Hart and continue to prove black capability. Soon, though, he would have the opportunity to provide even greater proof. Around the time he entered graduate school, former President Rutherford B. Hayes, the director of the Slater Fund for the Education of Freedmen, offered to underwrite the European education of any young colored man talented enough for the undertaking if such a person existed. Hitherto, Hayes told a Johns Hopkins audience, their chief and almost only gift has been that of oratory. Du Bois stepped up to the intellectual challenge. 2 years later, he enrolled at the University of Berlin, which at the time was the most distinguished university in the European world. The day before Du Bois's Harvard commencement address, a young Massachusetts congressman, Henry Cabot Lodge, introduced the Federal Elections Bill. Unlike reparations, this bill garnered the support of black elites. Its purpose was to mandate federal supervision of elections when local voters petitioned Washington about voter fraud. Also called the Force Bill, the proposed legislation infuriated the Southern segregationists who were listening to Lodge's speech at the U.S. Capitol. Lodge questioned the wisdom of the 15th Amendment but said it was still a federal responsibility to protect it. If any state thinks that any class of citizens is unfit to vote through ignorance, it can disqualify them, he said. It has but to put an educational quality